Welcome, everyone. This is Mia Ferraletto, publisher of New Observations magazine. Welcome to the New Observations podcast. I know we've been on break for a while, but we were working on our protest issue covering the violence at the Capitol on January 26th, and we took a few weeks off to publish that, pull it all together. And you'll be able to see it by the time this podcast comes out on our website, newobservations.org. It's an incredible compilation of work that was submitted by a number of artists in response to what happened on January 6, 2021 at the Capitol. So today we have the privilege to welcome Paulette Doté to our podcast. Paulette is one of the leaders, one of the co-directors of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Fund, and has been an activist for the majority of her adult life. She's been very, very involved with the American Indian Movement and other protest and activist organizations on behalf of human rights for everyone, and has done extraordinary work and lived an amazing life. Welcome to the show, Paulette.
Well, Mia, I'd sure like to meet the woman you just introduced.
You are the woman I just introduced.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You have had an extraordinary life, for today's purposes, I would really like us to focus on your involvement, your background, first of all, and your involvement on Pine Ridge during the years up to the present of the AIM movement and the Lakota and Anishinaabe and other tribes really standing up for their spiritual and religious and human rights. It's such an important time in our history.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, actually, I became involved with the American Indian Movement in 1972, when I met Leonard Peltier in Chicago. I have always been an anti-imperialist and have been in organizations that represented the struggles throughout the world of people throwing off the shackles of the colonialists. And I was working with an organization called Rising Up Angry in Chicago. And there was a call that was put out by the American Indian Movement and various other indigenous organizations to go to Washington and talk with the people at the Bureau of Indian Affairs regarding treaties and sovereignties. And at that time, I was living in Chicago, and as groups came through, Rising Up Angry had potluck fundraisers to provide gas money, got some new tires for him, some cars and some clothes, and then sent folks on their way. Well, Leonard wasn't able to make the first round because he was part of a warrior society that was dealing with the Menominee Monastery in Wisconsin. And so 2 weeks later, Leonard and his crew came, and we had a potluck for them and discussions about the whole questions of treaty and sovereignty and what that meant and how in the 1970s, what was the reality on their reservations. So after Leonard took off, he went to D.C., and then he went to Milwaukee, where he was accosted by a police officer when he was leaving a restaurant. And because even though the police officer was the aggressor, Leonard was charged with assaulting him and was put on trial. And he was eventually found not guilty because the policeman's girlfriend testified that he had Leonard's picture in his wallet and had been told to cause some trouble for this Indian guy, which he did.
Wow.
But Leonard was found not guilty. And it was a wonderful event. There was all kind of ceremonies. Crow Dog was there. He gave people some of their Indian names. From there, Leonard went to the West Coast. Wounded Knee had just finished by the time his trial was over, so he never was part of that particular action on the part of the American Indian movement. But we pick up with Leonard in New Mexico, and it was a big AIM conference, and the elders from Pine Ridge had come down there, and at a period of time during the conference, the grandmas made a plea to all the young AIMsters to please come to Pine Ridge, that they had the whole question of elders and traditional people being attacked and beaten up by the thugs and the goons. Now, of course, the goons were their real name was, you know, Guardians of the Ogallala Nation. And you would think with a name like that, they would be protecting their elders and traditional people, where in fact they were a particular hit squad of Richard Wilson, who was the tribal chairman at that time. And because of his relationship to the money people in D.C., he was able then to turn the money that came in to take care of everybody. It was used primarily by his family or as a way for him to buy more weapons and guns. But the traditional people and the people that lived in outlying areas were totally neglected, if not beaten and run off the road by the goons. So at that time, Pine Ridge had the highest death rate in the United States per capita. Within a two-year period, over 60 people were killed or supposed accidents by being run off the road, and people had petitioned the government, the Department of Justice, to investigate this. And the elders said, well, you can do it your way, but we're going to ask these young people to come and help us. And so there was two or three major camps on Pine Ridge, and Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler, Milok Butler, and many other young people went to Grandma Jumping Bulls, which is in Ogallala, which is a section of the Pine Ridge Reservation. Now, Bob, Dino, Leonard, and Milok were the oldest people there. And Joe Stuntz. Joe Stuntz and Milok were in their early 20s. But the other people that were there, Norman Brown and Wish Draper and Baby Aim, they were all teenagers. And Gene Roach, who is now one of our board members, was 15 at the time that this incident is taking place. And her brother, who was there with them, was 12. So you had this grouping of elders and young people who were being trained traditionally to learn their language and to support them. They had big gardens. The men cut wood for winter so everything would be ready for the elders. They took people to the grocery store. They just did what was necessary to protect the elders and the traditional people. And so while Leonard was there, he was also married to a Lakota woman, Andrea, and he had two children, Waha and Marquita. And that was his tie to Pine Ridge, was his relationship of his wife to the nation. So on this particular day, and Bob Robidoux also, he was married to a woman from the Cheyenne River Reservation, which is part of the overall Lakota Nation. And so Bob, who was an Anishinaabe from Turtle Mountain, North Dakota, along with Leonard, had married into the Lakota Nation. So this one morning, everybody is in the kitchen, the young guys are sleeping, and other people are doing things, and this car comes to the bottom of a sloping hill, and two men get out, they grab some weapons, and a firefight ensues. Leonard and Bob were up at the camp, which is, say it's the top of a little ridge. It's not that far, maybe a couple of football fields away. And Dino and Nelock were taking care of some other things. And this firefight, they hear this shooting. And Leonard runs to the other houses on Grandma Jumping Bull's land because there are families and children to make sure that they're safe. Grandma and Grandpa Jumping Bull had left for the day. Because Dennis Banks was in trial, and they had gone to support him. So this firefight ensues. There is gunfire going between the camp people and these two men. And at that point in time, when I talked to Bob and Leonard, nobody knew who these men were. They were two white guys in what Leonard and Bob later identify as Fed cars, and they had no idea why they were shooting, but they, without hesitation, returned fire to protect the people that were up on their land. After about an hour or so, the Feds start to move in and find out that the two young men at the bottom of the hill were in fact FBI agents, Ronald Collier and Williams, and they had been shot. When the men in the camp realize what's going on, they prepare to leave and take off, go through a culvert, and then run up this hill. It's a small mountain out there. With the feds and the goons and the sheriff and anybody that could get a gun firing at them as they went up to the top of the hill. They all escaped except our very wonderful young comrade, Joe Stuntz, who had been killed by a marshal. I believe it was. He was shot in the head, right between the eyes. This man was quite a distance away. And there was a goon that was next to him and was spotting for him, and he shot Joe. So they had a prayer for Joe, and then they all escaped and went up this hill. So here we have all these young people trying to get away, because when they find out, Bob said they knew that their lives were lost that day, that there would be no way they would ever get justice for some Indian people who would be charged with murdering two FBI agents. So they're able to escape for a while. Bob is captured a few days later, as is Dino and Nelock. And Leonard goes on a a trip with Dennis Banks to raise some money to help, as well as to build some support for him going to Canada, because the elders had told him that he should try and get political asylum because he had not been captured. So that was Leonard's aim, was to get to Canada and to seek political asylum. So this progresses for quite a while, and Bob and Dino are held in the Pennington County Jail, which is in Rapid City, South Dakota, about 90 miles north of Pine Ridge. And so Leonard gets to Canada. He does not get asylum. He is captured. And so the lawyers make a decision, because Leonard is going to fight extradition, that they should have the trial for Bob and Dino, and then be prepared for when Leonard comes back. So there's a move to send them to Iowa, and they go there, and Cedar Rapids. They go to Cedar Rapids, and there's a trial there. And this Judge McManus is a very thoughtful judge. He pays attention to what's going on. The trial moves along, and that's inside the courtroom. Outside the courtroom, there was an Indian camp, which we normally always do when there's trials. And there was a kitchen, and they fed people, and they had demonstrations, and they had the drum that was played, and people walked around the courthouse. And this was so far ago that all of the parents were still alive. Bob's parents, and Dino's parents came from Oregon to be part of the trial for their children. They, of course,
wow,
were children at this time. But, you know, so there was probably a camp of maybe between 75 and 100 that would rotate in and out. And they were very respectful, and they were treated very respectfully by that particular community. And during the trial, McManus allowed Bob and Dino's lawyer, who was Kunstler, and Bruce Ellison, to present facts that talked to why this firefight had taken place. Why were these young men and women at this elder's land? What had happened? The 60 people that had been killed, what was the atmosphere there that drove the elders to ask for outside people to come in and protect them? And so during this, the jury was actually acclimated to the realities of what was going on. You have to realize, of course, this is 3 years after Wounded Knee, which, of course, really the whole country watched. So the head of the FBI, I believe, was asked to testify, and he had just one question put to him, and that is, what is self-defense? Because that was what Bob and Dino said. They were not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. And so this man testifies, and he says, you know, self-defense is when you are attacked by an agency or people you do not know out of the blue, and then you have to respond in order to protect yourself and your family. And that was the only question he was asked, and he answered it. And so, of course, that showed that, in fact, what Bob and Dino's lawyers had argued was, in fact, the reality of the situation. And this all-white jury found Bob and Dino not guilty. And
which is an amazing event in and of itself.
Paulette, we are going to take our first commercial break right now,
okay.
So hold on for a minute and we will be back. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
My new book, Jesus, A New Vision, is an entirely new vision of the life of Jesus and what happened after. Among many other things, it is about why the resurrection happened and what happened to the teaching of Jesus that led to the creation of Christianity. It's an extraordinary and virtually untold story. Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods, says, "Whitley Strieber's take on Jesus is thought-provoking and inspiring. This is an important investigation filled with new insights. Highly recommended." Toby Johnson, author of Finding Your Own True Myth, What I Learned from Joseph Campbell, says, "Very wise and satisfying for the contemporary mind. My book does not deny the divinity of Jesus, but it looks at the power of the human mind and the human soul in a whole new way." Do not miss it. It's available now as a Kindle and as an audio book. It will be available within a week or so in paperback and hardcover. You can find it on Amazon. You can find the audiobook on Amazon, on Audible.com, and on Apple Books. Listen to this sample from the audiobook. Reading the canonical Gospels with the eye of a detective reveals much that has been hidden, more or less in plain sight. For example, it is clear that Jesus intentionally goaded the Romans into killing him. I think that the reason that he did this is understandable, as I will discuss. He was also helped by a group of people who are almost invisible in the Gospels, but not quite. They must have been incredibly learned. In fact, they must have known and understood the secret of death itself, and thus how to surmount it. They were not members of any known order, such as the Essenes. So who were they? And for that matter, as he was not a deity come to earth, who was he, really? Using a combination of a re-examination of his story and the application of scientific tools to, for example, study the Shroud of Turin, we can make exciting strides toward recovering the secrets that they must have known. Some of them are hidden in the Shroud, which it would now appear cannot have been a medieval forgery, as was incorrectly concluded back in 1988. As shall be seen, the evidence refuting that conclusion is strong. The implications of the resurrection event are amazing and exciting and have something very new to say not only about Jesus, but about us. Jesus, A New Vision. Get it today.
Welcome back to the show. So there must have been an enormous celebration at the closing of the trial for Dino and Bob.
There was a celebration, but there was also, inside the court, there was, you know, of course, nobody was screaming or yelling. Everybody stood and was excited. But the FBI, who were also, many of them were at the trial because they knew these two young men that had been killed, were in tears and just angry and hate made, you know, very white supremacist statements about Indian people and things like that. And what we have found out is that because they lost that trial, they did an analysis of it and they realized that they had not put a gun in Bob or Dino's hands. Yes, there had been a firefight. Everybody was firing back and forth at each other. But nobody was directly responsible for the death of the agents. And so they set about to make sure that the mistakes, quote, that their people made, the prosecutor made, would not happen when Leonard was brought back from Canada. And so Leonard is extradited, and instead of going to Cedar Rapids with Judge McManus, as he was supposed to do, there were some shenanigans pulled. McManus is pulled off the case, and it goes to North Dakota, goes to Fargo, North Dakota, and this man named Judge Benson takes over the case. It's a 360-degree turnaround. Judge Benson's rulings are, I will hear nothing bad about the FBI. I will not allow certain testimony. And, of course, as the judge, he can rule that that's irrelevant to the case, and so people don't hear what happened on Pine Ridge. People don't understand why people were called to come in and protect them. They also then try and put a gun in Leonard's hand, a 223, and they have all kinds of ballistic shenanigans around this, that the bullet that was found in these two young agents was too smashed up to be able to actually say what it was, but the coroner said, well, it looks to him like it could be a 223. And who has the 223? Well, one of the young persons put that, said, well, Leonard Peltier had a 223. And this young man was about 16 at the time, pardon me, and lived on a reservation. And when the FBI went to talk with him, they locked him in a room with two agents. His family was not allowed to be there. They didn't tell him anything about having a lawyer present. And they terrorized this young man so much that he said that he saw Leonard with this gun. Now, when he testified, he recanted it and said, I was so scared, this is what I said. But that's not the reality. There were many 223s there, and I don't know what Leonard had that day. However, that testimony of placing the gun in Leonard's hand became very damning evidence. They also tried to use the bullet itself to say that that came from a specific gun. And the FBI man that was in charge of ballistics got caught in a lie, an outright lie, that he finally had to come back and recant and say, oh, pardon me, I misspoke, when in fact he had lied about the how many people were around these bullets when they were in the lab. So altogether, Leonard's trial was harsh. The FBI told the judge that all these Indian people outside were going to raid the courtroom. So he had the jury sequestered. They had to ride in this van back and forth with the windows covered. They had sharpshooters on the roof of the courthouse in case they tried to get the judge. And the FBI really wrapped this judge right around their fingers. And by the time the jury was through hearing the evidence, Leonard became convicted of first-degree murder of two FBI agents and was given two life sentences. So the whole travesty of justice, if you compare Bob and Dino's trial and you read Leonard's trial and you say, well, why why couldn't Leonard also claim self-defense? Because one of the charges was aiding and abetting. But now who would he have aided and abetted? If Bob and Gino were innocent, then the only person he could have aided and abetted was himself. And so by certain misconduct, Leonard was convicted. And so I now, this is 77, and there is a defense committee for Leonard, started by his cousin Steve Robidoux and Raul Salinas in Seattle, and they put out a call, and I am working with this white anti-imperialist organization called the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, and they asked for support. And so we become involved with the work around Leonard, and the first time I meet Leonard, he and I laugh because we hadn't seen each other in about 5 years, and he said, "Oh my God, who would have thought this is how we would meet again?" So I, as part of my political work, worked on Leonard's case and have worked on Leonard's case since about 1977, 78.
Wow.
Then, of course, after Leonard's convicted and he goes to prison, there's an attempt on his life, and Leonard escapes, is recaptured, and we have this huge escape trial in 1979. And the committee were able, we have 3 defense houses, we have hundreds of people, we have community dinners every night, and Bob and Gino and Dennis Banks are on the TV talking about that. There's a walking altar that walks every day around the courthouse with people in flowers, with Leonard signs and things like that. And of course, the government says, well, you should have told the prison that someone was trying to kill you. And Leonard's lawyer said, "And Your Honor, if they're the people that are trying to kill you, who are you going to report it to?" But Leonard was convicted, and he was given 7 more years added to his 2 life sentences. And so I worked on Leonard's case as part of my political work ever since then. I've traveled to Europe many times and taken Leonard's statements of solidarity. And in fact, if you go to certain areas in Europe, like the Basque Country and areas of France, people know Leonard better than people here in the United States. So that's been part of our work, is develop the international, as well as trying to raise awareness here of not only Leonard's case, but the whole question of why he's in prison, which is, of course, the question of sovereignty and the right of self-determination for indigenous people on their land under their mode of government, not that imposed on them by the United States government. So it's been a long time. Bob and Gino have worked on Leonard's case for many years. Bob and I ran the defense committee in Lawrence, Kansas. We put out newspapers. We worked with Peter Matheson to develop for his research on In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. Michael Ashton.
And you were married. You were married.
Bob and I were married. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that I'm still here, is that now, through marriage, Leonard and I are cousins, and before Bob died, his thing was to make sure that Leonard got free, and so he said, you know, I mean, we didn't know he was going to die, but he was in Spain and coming back, and he said, no matter what, you know, this is our family's commitment to get Leonard out, so You just have to do it. And so we've done it, and I've continued on various different roads with Leonard. And now I'm one of the national directors here in Tampa, Florida, which is about 60 miles southwest of Coleman Prison, USP number 2, where Leonard has been incarcerated for the last 10 years.
We have to take our second and final commercial break, so hold on and we'll be right back.
Support UnknownCountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to UnknownCountry.com and subscribe today.
And welcome back to the show. Paulette,
yes.
you have been working on behalf of Leonard for over 40 years, and we've just elected a new president. Tell us about Leonard's continued efforts to obtain a parole, and what happened most recently with the Trump administration.
All right, well, let's start with Trump. People were very encouraged that Trump would look positively on Leonard's request for clemency. Because of his attitudes and actions against the FBI, and since we've been able to document the misconduct of the FBI, many people, including our lawyers, felt that Trump should have some sympathy or understanding that it wasn't just him and his family that had been targeted by the FBI, but Leonard and many other people as well. And so up until the day, the 20th, we were really hoping that Trump would, in fact, grant clemency to Leonard. He didn't do that, but he also didn't deny him. So we have a new petition that's our lawyer is in the process of putting together that will go to the Pardon Commission under the Biden administration. Once that petition is reviewed, it would then go to Biden to sign off on. So one of the things that we are doing is asking people to write to the White House, to Biden, to your congressperson, to your senator, asking them to support Leonard's request for clemency. Leonard, at this point in time, is 77, or will be in September. He is not in great health. He has diabetes, which he had fought and had it eradicated, but because of the COVID virus and the fact that people are not allowed to go out and walk around and exercise, and that the food that they're giving is totally full of sugars and carbs and, you know, just food that you would choose to eat maybe once in a while yourself, they are given every day. And so that has brought his diabetes back to the fore. He also, last year or 2 years ago, had a triple bypass. And he has some elderly people's male problems. He has problems with the prostate. He has bad arthritis in his hips and knee. And he has an aortic aneurysm that has not gotten large enough to be operated on. So we're asking people to, you know, write letters to the president and their congressional delegations to support Leonard's request for clemency. At the same time, we're also in the process of trying to get Leonard moved. Leonard is from Turtle Mountain, North Dakota, the Anishinaabe Nation. It is from their door to Leonard's door, practically coast to coast. His reservation is 10 miles from the Canadian border. So it's about 2,300 miles from there to Leonard's prison cell, which makes it extremely difficult for his family to visit him. I mean, when you talk about his brothers and sisters, he's in the middle, so he still has three or four older ones as well as four or five younger brothers and sisters. And by younger, I mean in their late 60s. And so for them to make this trip from North Dakota to Florida is extremely hard and difficult. So we are going to see about getting him a transfer to Oxford, Wisconsin, which is within the 500-mile range of where they try and place prisoners. And Oxford, Wisconsin is an FCI. And as of February 22nd, Leonard's security clearance will be reduced from a U.S. penitentiary to an FCI, which means that his being viewed by the authorities, his threat to them has been lessened by about 45%.
Wow.
So we're hoping that will happen within the next month to 6 weeks if it takes that long. And at the same time...
I just want to interject. Hold that thought. I just want to interject here that Leonard has been nominated for a Nobel Prize, what is it, six times? And and the people who have supported him globally include Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, organizations such as the Dalai Lama. Amnesty International support him and believe he should be free. The list goes on and on and on in terms of the support that he has. And aside from that, his art, which he's developed in prison, moves him into a whole other category as well, as a person of importance. So go ahead with your thought.
Okay, and all of that information that Mia just told you can be found on our website, which is www.whoisleonardpeltier.info/art. And the list of awards is on the website as well. And so the third prong is to deal with a parole, a request for a parole hearing, which with the reduction of his security would show that at the age of 77, that he is not a threat to anybody in the society, and in fact would be welcomed back on Turtle Mountain with open arms, as his family is there, his children live in Bismarck and in the whole northern section of North Dakota. The nation has been said that they will help build a house for him once they know he's on his way. So everything is set for Leonard to go home. And so this year we're really emphasizing this three-prong way, a legal way of trying to get Leonard out. And so if you're interested, if you go to the website on the bottom of the first page, you can sign up for our newsletter. And that comes out about every 2 weeks. And in it, the last couple of issues, we've had new observation, the wonderful edition that Mia and her crew put out about Pine Ridge and included about 40 of Leonard's paintings. So you can see for yourself the breadth of his painting history. Like he said, if he had been out, he never would have been a painter because he never would have had time. But being incarcerated, this was the way that he could stay in touch with his family and friends and memories of what it was to be an Indian and to be, you know, driving around.
Oops. Could you say that again? We lost you.
Oh, and I said to be driving around with his nephews and nieces and going to ceremonies, you know, and just living as an indigenous person on the land that he has fought so long to protect.
Well, he's really, and you can speak more eloquently on this than I, but Leonard is living his Sundance for his people. He's really, you know, making a daily sacrifice on behalf of all of us, but particularly on behalf of Indigenous people everywhere, as he remains incarcerated for something that I and many, many other people believe he did not do.
But, you know, one of the things that's very important is that Leonard and Bob and Dino were part of and are still part of the Indian Wars. The persecution of
yes.
Indian people did not go away. Wounded Knee showed this. 3 years after Wounded Knee, you still have the FBI attacking. So even though there was a loss of life, this was a battle. Just like people are doing around the world to protect their sovereignty. So whether
Absolutely.
Or not those weapons were the ones that the agents were killed by, this was a battle for sovereignty for Native people and has to be understood within the historical context of what it means to be living under a colonial empire, you know, to have... People tell you, you can't practice your religion. You know, I'm going to cut your hair off and you're never going to be allowed to speak your language. So whether or not Leonard or Bob or Gino was guilty is immaterial. The fact that this white supremacist government thinks it continue to persecute indigenous people on their own land is wrong, and they are going to be called for it, just like NoDAPL, pipelines and the young people that are standing up. You know, that's really what people need to understand, is that this is a question of sovereignty that has been a struggle for 400 years for the indigenous people of this hemisphere.
Well, as Chase Iron Eyes has said numerous times in his public statements, at this moment in time, we are all Native Americans, you know. I mean, human rights have deteriorated to such an extent at this moment that we're all fighting for our own, for our sovereignty and for human rights. We're all in this together. You know, as Native Americans say, you know, we are all related. And Henry Red Cloud took me to the Jumping Bull property on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And knowing the history and knowing that these two FBI agents went driving onto the Jumping Bull property looking for someone who supposedly stole a pair of cowboy boots, you know, under the ruse of getting onto the property, in and of itself, is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary setup, really, to instigate this altercation.
Right, exactly. That's right. That's another battle. They came dressed for battle, and afterwards they were all dressed in their camo. They had these huge PRCs. They had these vehicles that were right off the reservation waiting for something to happen, because at the same time as the firefight, Dickie Wilson was giving away a quarter of the Indian reservation of Pine Ridge, and they were expecting there to be some problems. Not a shootout, but Native people resisting Dick Wilson's, you know, giving away part of their land so that he got some profits for himself. So they were ready, and they rolled in, and you can see incident at Ogallala, which is one of the stories of Leonard, or Warrior, which is another story, My Life as a Sundance, which is Leonard's thoughts about himself and his life in prison and his culture and spirituality. And so all these are available, and I hope all your podcast listeners, you know, will spend some time and, you know, get reacquainted with the reality of what it means to be a person of color, an indigenous person under this government.
Also, Dick Wilson was trading off the rights to the uranium on the Pine Ridge Reservation at the same time all of this was going on, which is depicted in the movie Thunderheart, which Michael Apted also made, as well as Incident at Ogallala, which is more the documentary of it. And Thunderheart was written by screenwriter John Flisco, who contributed a very powerful article in New Observations magazine in the Pine Ridge issue, documenting his writing of that screenplay. So this is all history. These are all facts. This is the type of thing that people deal with every day on the Pine Ridge Reservation and other reservations throughout our country. And the average American knows almost nothing about the situation on Pine Ridge, the situation here at home. And it's only through exposure and education that awareness and change can occur.
That's right. As a high school teacher, you could see, I mean, they were taught about the Pilgrims. If you were in a very progressive school, there might have been during the civil rights era a small paragraph about Wounded Knee, and that's it. And that's all they learned. They didn't learn anything unless, as a teacher, you wanted them to have an overview of the treaties that were broken, the land that was stolen, all the mineral resources, and why the most impoverished people in the United States are those indigenous people who are there and protect Mother Earth. You know, it's a crime against humanity the way this government and the greed, as Indian people call it, the Washishu, the eaters of fat, have attempted to devastate these nations. And yet, you know, they are strong and they are surviving. And now there's three or four Native women in Congress, the Representative Deb Haaland and Therese Davis, you know, and young women and young Native men that are running in their own district. So, you know, we are a mighty, mighty nation, they say, and they will continue to survive, and they do it through their culture and their ceremonies and, you know, the raising of their family and their children to follow on through the next seven generations.
Well, can you speak about that, Paulette, because we are now in the time of the seventh generation. This is the predicted time when everyone would come together and work together for the good of Mother Earth. Do you see that happening now?
Well, you know, I am not a Native person, so from my political perspective as an ally, and I would say I am under the leadership of Leonard Peltier, Chase Iron Eyes, Dennis Banks, Russell Means, all of these people who I have studied with and worked with, and followed their direction that we need to pay attention. You know, we need to understand that this climate change is a reality, that if we really want to protect Mother Earth, if we want to protect the ocean, maybe we have to give up these plastic straws, which, living in Florida, you know, is devastating the sea animals. And people say, well, I have the right to have this. Well, you have a right to keep this land safe for your children and your grandchildren, and not be so greedy that you can't see to the future. So we really need to educate. We need to be able to sit down and talk about these things. We need to have conferences. People need to understand cultures and not look at somebody else's religion or somebody else's language as foreign and therefore has no place here, when in fact the culture and the language and the ceremonies are what has maintained Native sovereignty and identity since, you know, Christopher Columbus. Since Leif Erikson, since the European invaded the indigenous peoples throughout this hemisphere, North and South America. So we need to step back. We need to listen to them. We need to follow some leadership. We need to struggle within the white community against racism, against the whole question of, well, why should they have it? They have a treaty. Well, they have a treaty, but every treaty, 323 treaties, were made, and every one was broken. So when people say, well, they have all of this, well, you need to go live in their shoes and see what they've gotten out of these treaties. So as white people, we need to take the blinders off. We need to sit down. We need to read some books. We need to read about from Vine Deloria, who is this wonderful Native philosopher, and understand that there is another part of our psyche which relates us to not just Mother Earth, but, you know, when you take a walk in the desert or you take a walk in the mountains, that you protect it. You don't throw trash down. If you smoke, you take everything out with you, and that we all want this for our children. I mean, it's incredible, beautiful nation we have, but if we're not careful, we're not going to have it. And maybe some of the people who are listening who are young, their grandchildren will never have the same privileges of going to these national parks or, you know, being able to swim in the ocean because it's so polluted. And that will be on us. That will be on this generation for not listening and following the directions of people who have been caretakers of this land for so long.
Well, Vine Deloria's extraordinary book, God is Red, covers the Native view of religion and also brings environmental issues, you know, in throughout. It was published in 1972. It's just an extra, you know, at the time of Wounded Knee, it's just an extraordinary document and testament to Native spirituality and inner strength.
Right. It is. It's a wonderful book. If people only read one book to try and understand, that would be a wonderful book to read. You'll almost feel like you should light some cedar or some sage when you sit down to read it so that you can step out of this reality and into the shoes of someone who has lived that life. So that you're a different part of your brain and your heart is opened up and you somehow have empathy for what other people are going through. But, yes, that's very true. That's very true. And don't forget, any questions you have, you can call me at 218-790-7667. This is the National Office of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and our website is whoisleonardpeltier.info. And, Mia, it's so wonderful to talk to you. You know, we could probably spend two or three more hours.
Well, Paulette, it's been
our conversation.
It's been an honor working with you over the past year and getting to know you. You were instrumental in the publication of New Observations magazine on the Pine Ridge issue. You just made it a joy to work with Leonard's art and pull it all together. I do want to say here about his art specifically, in 2012, the American-Polish sculptor Joanna Malinowska was chosen to participate in the Whitney Biennial at the Whitney Museum in New York City. And as part of her installation, she chose to hang one of Leonard's paintings and put a sign next to it saying, "This painting was done by Leonard Peltier. He should be here, but he's in prison." And she had the support of the Whitney Museum in doing that. And one of the things we're planning to do at this time, and we just have our first couple of participants, and in fact, both of them, James Tunney and Addie Mayer, are people who've been interviewed on the New Observations podcast, and their work has been in New Observations magazine. They're both international artists. James is a barrister, a mystic, a writer, and an artist from Ireland, currently living in one of the Scandinavian countries. And he made a beautiful painting that says "Free Leonard Peltier" using the four directional colors. It's just a very powerful piece, which is in the latest issue of New Ups. Isn't it amazing? You can feel the spirit.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
It's in the newest.
The other thing I want to let people know is that through this New Observation Pine Ridge issue, Leonard was so happy. He said, "I am so touched to think that I would be included in this." He said, "You know, I have to thank everybody. I have to thank Mia and all the people that worked on this." He said, "You know, for a short period of time," he said, "I was out of the prison. I was just back in Pine Ridge," and he said, "I can't tell them enough of how that short little time away did my heart so well." So you know that for him to be able to mentally get out of that place after 44 years, for him it was like being able to go to Sundance. So.
Wow.
I have to thank you for that, because it's every day when you get up and the bars are there, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to go back to what you remember. But that wonderful issue allowed him out of that cell for a time in his heart and mind. So we really thank you so much from the committee.
Oh, well, that's so wonderful to hear. And it was a joy and an honor to put the issue together. And I have to say, every time I open it, the light that comes out of it, you know, the energy, the power from Leonard and the Lakota people on Pine Ridge, it's palpable. You know, you can absolutely feel it. But you know, and that's what James Tunney was responding to when he made that painting, Free Leonard. And Addie Mayer, who does the Space Rider, the artist and filmmaker who made the Space Rider films, one of them on Pine Ridge, is actually doing two special pieces. One is a drawing, but the other is a photo collage of the Space Rider on the Space Rider horse carrying a flag that says Free Leonard Peltier. And our goal is to put together a collection of 50 works of art made specifically in support of Leonard and his freedom. There'll be a musical component to all of that too, but we're really pushing forward to put together this group in the next several months. Very exciting.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Well, Paulette, thank you so much for joining us. We will have all of your contact information and information about the Defense Fund and Leonard, along with this wonderful interview. Thank you.
Oh, miigwech.
And we will see everyone back next week. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now.